otherwise noted.
This is Cat Meow.
And this is Becky.
And we want to hang out with you.
The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
Join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the film screening of Mother, Daughter, Sister on Saturday, October 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Mother, Daughter, Sister exposes the Burmese military's practice of using rape as a weapon of war. Testimonies from survivors, witnesses, and activists explore the far-reaching impact of sexual violence upon women and communities as they call for justice and a unified stand for an end to impunity. A panel discussion will follow the film and includes the filmmaker and local community leaders and activists. Again, that's Mother, Daughter, Sister on Saturday, October 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock a.m. and time for the beloved community, which welcomes the Imam of the Islamic Center of Portland, the only Shia mosque in the metro area. At 10, Valley Views continues the discussion with activists from SEIU Oregon Care Works about their work in the long-term care community, or economy. We'll round out that hour with flashpoints and then bring you the Digital Divide at 11, talking to the co-author of the co-curator of Fireboat Micro Cinema about their ongoing film series. This can only happen with the support of the community. That's UNITY. So, go to kboo.fm and click on the little maroon triangle that says donate in yellow. And now, as promised, the beloved community.
The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
Good morning. This is the beloved community. I'm John Shack. The beloved community is heard every second Friday from 9 to 10. On KBOO, and you can find podcasts of this show by going to kboo.fm/beloved community, or you can go to my website, progressivespirit.net, and get podcasts of this show as well as my weekly syndicated show called Progressive Spirit. That's progressivespirit.net. I'm very excited today. I have two guests. One in the studio with me is Imam Mohsen Al-Dalami. He is the Imam of the Islamic Center of Portland in Beaverton. And I also have a guest on the phone, Ellie Elliott, Dr. Susan Ellie Elliott from Red Lodge, Montana. And she has a new book out called Family Empires, Roman and Christian. So we're going to be talking about empire, and we're going to be talking about Arba'in, which is the pilgrimage that is happening now, actually, going on in Iraq that I fortunately have an opportunity to undertake. And so I'm trying my best to learn some things about Islam and Shia Islam, as well as Hussein. And we're going to hear about all of those things this morning on the beloved community. And so I'm going to check, first of all, and see if Ellie is with us. Ellie, are you there?
I'm here. Yes, I am.
Ellie, welcome to the beloved community. It's so good to see you. It's always good to be able to introduce friends from different settings. And so I want to introduce you, Ellie, to Mohsen, who I'll tell you first about Ellie. Ellie, I knew from Also, I'm from Montana myself, and know Ellie through the West Star or the Jesus Seminar, the think tank that works on historical Jesus studies. And Mohsen I know because he is the imam of the mosque right across the street from me here in Beaverton. And so we're going to be talking about some different things. So again, welcome, Ellie. I want to tell a little bit about Ellie. Ellie is a writer, lecturer, workshop leader, and environmental activist. She's based in Red Lodge, Montana, in the course of a career in community organizing and ministry. She also taught for seminaries, a university, a community college, and a leadership school. She's the author of Cutting Too Close for Comfort, Paul's Letter to the Galatians, in its Anatolian cultic context. Her scholarly work focuses on the pagan and Roman imperial backgrounds of early Christianity, including Greco-Roman mystery cults, particularly the cult of Sabeel, and Central Anatolian proper popular religiosity. Her scholarly articles and reviews have appeared in the Journal of Biblical Literature, Catholic Biblical Quarterly, Biblical Research, Semeia, Bryn Mawr, Classical Review, and others. She recently campaigned for a legislative seat in Montana and is currently organizing a grassroots think tank in the Big Sky region. Her latest book, and one we're going to talk about today, is Family Empires, Roman and Christian, Volume 1. She, along with Dr. Deborah Saxon, will be speakers at a conference at Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton entitled One Big Happy Family? Facing the Beast of Empire. That's coming up October 19th and 20th. You can go to southmin.org for details. Ellie, welcome again.
Yes, and thanks for inviting me, Don. It's a pleasure.
Well, tell me about this book, Family Empires, Roman and Christian, Volume 1, and the upcoming Volume 2. What are you setting out to do with this work?
Well, John, it starts with the work of George Lakoff and his work, Moral Politics. He's a linguist who's discerned root metaphors in language, and he did some study of contemporary political discourse and discovered that everybody talks about the nation as a family. Everybody's assuming a family, but what's got us divided and even more divided than when he wrote is the form of family that we're assuming. And his great gift is to discern something other than the traditional family values family, which he labels the strict father family, but he also discerns something he calls the nurturant parent, which is the liberal assumption about what family is. And I think most briefly, those are distinguished by role definition. In that traditional family, the strict father family, you have everybody divided by family roles. There's father, mother, children, and you know each one has their own roles and responsibilities, kind of answerable to the father. And they raise children for a fundamentally competitive world. That's the worldview that they're raising the kids to go out there and compete, And then the nurturant parent, which is the assumption of kind of underlies, I don't like the word liberal, but let's just use it. That assumes that we're raising children for a community cooperation and a world that needs to be constructed as cooperative, and there's a lot less role definition. So when you take that back to the first century and look at Caesar Augustus and the family system that he built the empire on, the Roman strict father family also includes slaves and slavery. And it's a different strict father family system and much more violent and much more kind of horrendous, I think, would be a good word for it. And Caesar Augustus built, it wasn't even a metaphor. He literally built the Roman Empire as his personal family. And he could not have become a one-man ruler of the empire without becoming its father, because the Romans just hated kings. So what he did was to assume all kinds of monarchical powers and own the empire, while being its father and everybody preserving the institutions of the republic and all the he restored the republic and became its father and therefore its king, but they couldn't use that word. So what I do is to study that and how the family system was changing, actually, and the houses were changing during that era. And then I'll be going on, and I've studied some of the resistance, just a smattering of resistance movements. And then the second volume will deal with how the Christians were resisting, but also reinstating the empire in a more virulent form as the Christian empire that then became the imperial mission agenda to dominate the world with Western culture. So that's it in a nutshell. There's lots more to it.
All right.
The resistance movements, but yeah.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of those in just a second. Ellie Elliott, my guest, if you're just joining us on the Beloved Community, author of Family Empires, a Roman and Christian. So what about before Augustus? I mean, Alexander the Great, would that be a similar thing, or would he be different, or... Or is it like any male empire is like this heavy father family?
You know, there's distinct versions of this. I don't go with kind of a dualist view of the world. In fact, it was interesting to see that Mithridates, who is quite an emperor, also had a kind of cooperative view of the world. And had there were some interesting things about women and slaves and his efforts and he was anti-Roman, so it was, I mean, there's all sorts of interesting dimensions to this. Alexander is definitely an imperialist, and Augustus certainly modeled himself in Alexander's image. That's, you know, so yes, but yeah. It's not all, they can't all be painted with the same brush. It's
yeah.
Kind of,
well, it seems that Augustus. Augustus introduced really a new element, though, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, when I saw your title, Family Empire, I first thought of the House of Saud, as in terms of Saudi Arabia, you know, or how they just kind of took over Arabia. Here's the family empire. And I'm thinking of those guys, a regime along with the U.S. and Israel, who have been terrorizing the Middle East. Is there a connection between the family empire of 2,000 years ago with Augustus and some contemporary empires?
Yeah, I have not studied the Saudi, you know, I haven't studied that at all in depth, but it certainly, as I was writing this first volume in 2016, and as things were unfolding, I kept thinking, couldn't we just have Augustus? He was smart. ruthless, but smart.
Okay.
Why did we have to skip to Caligula or Nero or something? But you can see with that family empire piece of it, I mean, the more I've studied this, the more literal the family ownership of the empire, and it, you know, it was with the imperial cult and also with the ownership issues and the bureaucracy and just taking over things. You see the Trump organization and the Trumps, becoming that family empire. I mean,
even his son-in-law, right?
His son-in-law, you know, he wants to put his daughter into the UN now.
Uh-huh.
I think that's I think that's dead in the water, I hope. But there is that image, and it's just the understanding, and when you look at the kind of the root metaphor, the family that his supporters assume, these things make sense, and they can... This root metaphor starts to explain why this evangelical religious devotion to him is kind of part and parcel of religion. And the family system that they assume.
You know,
it's really hard to crack.
Yeah, because I remember hearing as he was running for election, people talking about that he represents an authoritarianism that some people find very attractive. And that certainly goes to this model of the father as the authority.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's the Father God that they're looking at, and then also this divinely appointed ruler. And it isn't, I think partly understanding that it isn't that it's what they want, it's just what they assume. And what we assume, I mean, I saw a meme come across Facebook. What we assume is that we're looking for making a cooperative world. At least that's what I assume. I mean, I was raised to be, raised to be a productive citizen to help the world be better, you know, and serve the community. That was what we were raised for. And I was raised in a very much a nurturant parent family. And it's these things that at a gut level beneath what we think rationally, what we're assuming, that's what I'm working on understanding by understanding it in the ancient world and also gaining hope from the resistance there too. So it's
Well, let's go to the resistance first, but I want the first one I want to talk about are some of the effects. What are the effects, for example, in ancient Rome, but also in contemporary societies when we assume or accept as normal this authoritarian kind of rule? What are the effects on the people?
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, in the ancient world, when you consider the dynamics of slavery and slavery in the U.S. isn't, the effects of that aren't over, and the effects of the effects of taking over. Hello.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm with you.
Oh.
Yeah. Those. Okay. It isn't ended. Yeah, we are the effects
new
of
phone system. Yeah. So one of the things that defines slavery, and I think this is where I'm moving towards. Just a trigger warning. Talk about rape. But slaves, partly the ownership of a body and viewing this person as a body, as a slave, makes them sexually fair game for the master and the owner and whoever the owner gives them to. And it's kept slavery only works with the threat of violence. It has a lot more dimensions to it, but that's the rock bottom base of it is violence. And then at the workshop, I want to talk about the violence in the arena and the martyrs and how they reinstate the empire. But slavery is and sexuality, this whole sexual use dimension of it is really profound. That's a big element of the impact of it and how people think of themselves, and just it's hard to contemplate, but there's, you see these elements of resistance of these, you know, these little inscriptions of two slaves. One gives it's a funerary inscription for the other one and how much he loves him. They maintain relationships in spite of being broken apart and how they're treated. People will resist with all they have by forming relationships that uphold each other. And that's, you know, just something we need to keep in mind. But also Deb will talk more about how this affects the self and people, especially women, claiming themselves. So I'm interested to hear what she's going to come up with next weekend too. So,
Deborah Saxon.
So, but the internalizing of, I think pietas kind of expresses it. It's kind of involves affection and obedience, all wrapped up in one. So this internalizing of always trying to please the one above you, and always kind of looking to the interest and the desires of the one above you to serve. I mean, that's what's expected in this kind of patriarchal system.
In many ways, that relationship started
to be broken when Augustus took power. I mean, it has influences up and down the scale. It's not just somebody at the top, not just a change of leadership at the top, but a change of the system that happened under his one-man rule. So,
My guest, Ellie Elliott, author of Family Empires, Roman and Christian, Volume 1, Volume 2. When's Volume 2 coming out?
Next year sometime.
Next year, good.
Probably 2020.
All right. And Ellie and Dr. Deborah Saxon are going to be speakers at a conference at Southminster Presbyterian in Beaverton entitled One Big Happy Family? Facing the Beast of Empire on October 19th and 20th. And as you can hear from this interview, this isn't just dry history. We're talking about how things are unfold even in our time today, how these models are continuing, but also forms of resistance. And I want you to close with me as you've been studying this, what did you find as the most helpful form of resistance in ancient times, and perhaps that might help us to think about it today?
Yeah. I think it's helpful to see that there was a variety, and I just want to mention a couple of things. One, I want to talk more at the workshop about the different resisting responses to rape. The Roman example is Lucretia, who commits suicide for the family's honor, essentially, and that's part of the foundation narratives of the Roman Republic. And in contrast to that, you see Queen Boudica, who has a whole other view of family that's discernible. And she's, when her daughters are raped by the Romans and she has to watch this and then she's flogged, the response is not commit suicide because we're contaminated or polluted. The response is raising up an army of hundreds of thousands of Britons to throw the Romans out. They almost did. And the cynics are really intriguing because they have a whole different viewpoint. And there's just a lot more radical resistance than the Christians. And that's part of the point, but I want to look at that, and then the transgender resistance of the cult that I've studied, the cult of Cybele and Attis, is also quite fascinating, because as the Romans take over, they become more project themselves more assertively as androgynous, the priests or the cultic functionaries of this cult, who have their temple, by the way, right next to the palace of Caesar Augustus. It's quite an intriguing little turn of events that makes that happen. So lots of intriguing things, but that resistance isn't, it's not like there's the empire and then the resistance is one big movement. It's quite a variety of ways that people come up with to resist, and I think it will behoove us to start looking at some of those varieties and honoring them.
Absolutely. Dr. Ellie Elliott has been my guest here from Red Lodge, Montana, author of Family Empires, Roman and Christian. And Dr. Ellie will be, like I say, in Beaverton on the October 19th and 20th. You can go to southmin.org for details on that conference. Thank you so much for being with me and for this book and these insights.
Yeah, so I look forward to seeing some of your audience on next weekend, and have a great trip.
Because that's
inspiring.
Where we're getting, you know, I'm going to transition now to Musin, and that's where I'm headed off into Iraq, and certainly we're talking about resistance, I think, there in many ways with this movement from the Shias and Arbain and whatnot. So we're going to talk a little bit about that here. So thank you, Ellie. I will say goodbye to you, and I'm glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. And my guest in the studio with me is Imam Mohsen Al-Dahlami. And he is the Imam of the Islamic Center of Portland. The Islamic Center of Portland is located in Beaverton at the corner of Denny and Hall, just for full disclosure, right across from the congregation I serve. It's the only Shia mosque in Portland. And Imam Mohsen Al-Dahlami was born in Iraq, and he moved to the United States during the regime of Saddam Hussein. And Mohsen is here to talk about Shia Islam, and in particular the annual visitation to the shrine of Imam Hussein, not to be confused with Saddam Hussein, but Imam Hussein, who is the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. And that visitation is in Karbala, Iraq, and it's happening here. Well, actually, it's happening right now as we're going on. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I want to begin just kind of with some general questions about your mosque, or is it called a masjid? Maybe you can explain that.
So masjid is the Arabic word for the place of worship, and mosque is the translation in English, and I think it came from Spanish, actually.
Okay.
So masjid and mosque, it's the same based in the translation. But our place, we called it a center because there is kind of a religious rules and regulation govern the use of the masjid. And this is why we made our place as a center, so to not let these restrictions, if I may say, to be sometime preventing some people may come and use the center.
And you have, is this the only Shia masjid in Oregon?
Actually, it is.
Okay, so the whole state.
The whole state, yes.
And and there's also another term, a Husseiniya.
So Husseiniya is a kind of another, you may refer to it as a religious community center, where usually the commemoration of a specific religious occasion, and it's been called Husseiniya after the name of Imam Hussein. And again, the use of it will be less restrictive than if they use it as a mosque or a masjid, because mosque and masjid specifically is as a place of worship regarding to doing the prayers, the ritual prayers, the Friday prayers, and so on and so forth. But the Husseiniya is the place where the community of that neighborhood would get together to commemorate the occasions of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein or the martyrdom of other imams or special other occasions. So it's kind of more open space for people or for the community, I should say, to use rather than the aspect of mosque, which is usually used daily for rituals, daily prayers, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and the Husseiniya of Greater Seattle is actually the one sponsoring, invited me to go on this trip, this visitation. So let's talk about Hussein. Who was Hussein?
So Hussein, he is the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And he is the son of Imam Ali, who was the first successor based in the Shia theology to the Prophet after Prophet Muhammad passed away. And in the term of the rank, he is the third imam for the Shia. So after his father, Imam Ali, the first imam, his older brother, Imam Hussein, the second, and Imam Hussein was the third one. And historically, he was supposed to be the so-called legitimate caliph, because there was a treaty between Imam Hussein and Muawiyah, who was the caliph in that time, that if Imam Hussein died and Muawiyah died, Imam Hussein will become the legitimate ruler of the Islamic State. But Muawiyah did not want to do that, and that's why he managed to force people with temptation or with the threat to take the allegiance for his son Yazid, who historically was not a good person, and this is why many Muslims refused to give him the allegiance, and this is why Imam Hussein started his resistance and rising against Yazid, because for him that was the most violated aspect of the Islamic rules and Islamic teaching, and violating the rules of the Prophet of Islam. This is why Imam Hussein rose against him, and eventually he been murdered or become martyrs with very few companion of his in the 61 Hijri, which is almost 772 on Gregorian calendar, and that was in the land of Karbala, or part of closed desert of Karbala of today.
And he, his story is so profound and inspiring that he was willing to stand up for truth, even though it meant certain death.
Exactly, and that really the aspect of standing for the principles made Imam Hussein being inspired not only by Muslims but by many other people who took him as a symbol for securing freedom and securing for resisting for any oppression, for any unjust within the society or within community. As I mentioned to you earlier, there are many great thinkers or many activists related to Imam Hussein. An example of the say of Gandhi, the guy who liberated India from the occupation of British, that he said, "I learned the resistance from Hussein."
He learned it from Hussein. So so Hussein is a bigger figure than he's almost a global type of figure.
Exactly.
I am speaking with Imam Mohsen Al-Dahlami. He is the Imam for the Islamic Center of Portland. We're talking about Imam Hussein, and we're going to be talking about right now the pilgrimage to Arba'in. But before that, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a music break. We're going to play this song from the Tijani Brothers, and this is called "I Will Crawl on My Knees to You, Hussein," and then we're going to come back and talk about what Arba'in is. This is the Beloved Community.
سيدي يا حسين I will come crawling to you حسين I will come crawling to you حسين They can cut my arms and my legs They can take everything that I have I will come crawling to you Every day it cuts me inside I'm so very far from your side I would give away these eyes Just to catch a glimpse of your shrine If I have to cross the seas And every desert in between I will come crawling to you, Hussein I will come crawling to you, Hussein They can cut my arms and my legs They can take everything that I have I will come crawling to you, Hussein I will come crawling to you, Hussein I can tell you that I'm insane In the love of my master, Hussein
The Tijani Brothers, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. I will come crawling to you, Hussein. Speaking about Arba'in, visiting the shrine of Arba'in, can you talk to me about what Arba'in is?
I just want to make a comment regarding the inspiration of this song where
yes.
it says crawling. Because historically there was so much resistance for any government which considered by the Shia non-legitimate. They were trying to prevent this connection between the communities and Imam Hussein. And over time, they tried to apply such draconian measures to prevent the people to go to the shrine of Imam Hussein. Because in our belief that we have to connect to Imam Hussein, but actually connect to his principles. And as his most principles to resist the unjust, to resist the oppression, that's why the government all this time preventing people to go. And historically, some time they were kind of trying to amputate a limb or a hand of these people. But that's the inspiration came, even if they cut our limbs, we will come crawling to you. Imam Hussein means that we will connect to your principles. So the Arba'in, first of all, the term Arba'in means the 40, or when you add the defined article, Al-Arba'in means the 40th. And it is the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. And it happens to be his family, after he's been taken as a prisoner of war, after the 10th of Muharram, which is the day where Imam Hussein was murdered and with his companions, when the family came back in their way to go back to their hometown, which is Medina of today in Saudi Arabia, they happened to arrive in the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. And since that time, the Shia community started to commemorate Imam Hussein beside the 10th day of Muharram, which is when the day he actually killed, that to make another memorization for him, to create this active attachment between the communities and Imam Hussein.
So this right now is a season of mourning for exactly. Hussein, for Shia Muslims.
Yes, exactly. The actual day could happen in the 30th of October of this month, because we follow the lunar calendar. And this is why people started from all over, if I may say the word, actually nowadays. It used to be only local peoples or the cities or the towns close to Karbala, which is the city where Imam Hussein Shrine is now. They start to kind of showing more attachment to the role or to the cause of Imam Hussein. They will walk and to show more readiness for sacrifice and giving whatever it takes to attach to Imam Hussein and his cause. And this became the tradition of more and more people to do this procession or the marching from whatever they live and then reach the Karbala. Not necessarily in the same day, because it depends in every individual circumstances. And nowadays, actually, people coming from Iran, from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, from Syria, from Lebanon, and some people, they really took like a whole month walking.
You said that some people walk from Iran itself. We're talking, yes, 400, 500 miles.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why it has become, as if may call it, as a phenomena rather than just a commemorations. And many, many people fly from over countries like India, Iran, Pakistan, Lebanon, so many other Shia communities in European countries. They would come fly to Iraq, for instance, to Najaf, and then they walk from Najaf to Karbala, which is about 80 to 70 kilometers between the Karbala and Najaf.
That's what I'm, inshallah, going to be doing.
Yeah,
coming up is that walk from Najaf to Karbala, which you say is 80 kilometers or so. Yeah. And that is a very popular one. I mean, they've done some estimates. It's hard to know. Low estimates, 10 million, but high estimates up to 20 million over the course of this period.
Exactly, yeah. And the significant people started from Najaf, because Najaf has the shrine of Imam Ali, the father of Imam Hussein. And he was, again, the biggest resistance to the oppression and to not so-called legitimate rules of that time. That's why people started from Najaf.
Mohsin Al-Dalimi is my guest. He is the Imam of the Islamic Center of Portland on Denian Hall in Beaverton. And we're talking about Arba'in and Hussein and the pilgrimage. You grew up in Najaf, Iraq.
That's right.
So you were on this pilgrimage during the time of Saddam Hussein and before. Can you tell me a little bit about what Najaf was?
So Najaf, significant of Najaf is the biggest Shia theology seminaries, and a lot of people try to go to keep this commemoration of Imam Hussein or this march. But because Saddam Hussein and his secular rule consider that against or oppose him, because he didn't really feel he was a legitimate ruler, and the resistance were coming from the Shia community in the south and middle of the Iraq. This is why they tried to prevent people from walking, because walking is kind of a public acknowledgement between the community and Imam Hussein. It is a symbol of the resistance against the oppression of Saddam at that time.
Mm-hmm.
This is why they put so much effort to prevent the people, and most people with limited numbers, because the pressure of that time, would go and try to walk to Imam Hussein using the back roads, the back ways, Through the what you call it, through the ruler land, and then they would kind of walk during the night, so they would not be detected during daytime by the agent of the government and so on and so forth. But all those, you know, oppression years in Iraq, really the number was very limited, because it takes really a committed person to do this. And of course the motivation is as well, there is a great reward when you walk, rather than just to take a car and go, you know, to visit the shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, is just showing the more commitment toward the cause, toward Imam Hussein.
And that's a great, and a great deal of danger. And you did this yourself.
Yes, I did. And I remember it took us like two nights, because, you know, we cannot continue walking. Just that's why it takes us a little bit longer.
And it was very dangerous. I mean, you lost a friend.
Yes, yeah. Actually, one of the years I was going there, I've been arrested and been tortured. And actually, there was kind of a minor uprising within the people of Najaf, because the oppression was so high and many young people decided to go opposing publicly the government. And then they brought many soldiers and arrested many, many peoples and executed quite a few peoples in that time. Actually, some people in Najaf still commemorate that uprising back in 1975.
And I'm speaking again with Imam Mohsen Al-Dalami, the Imam at the Islamic Center of Portland. We're talking about Arba'in. And so during the time of Saddam Hussein, we're talking just a few people, obviously very committed people, people willing to risk their lives
to go there, yes.
To go and visit the shrine of Imam Hussein. But it has been a continuous visitation throughout history, in spite of various forms of oppression.
Yes, but the regime was resisting this simple commitment for people walking. I mean, they, of course, could not prevent people from going to visit the shrine of Imam Hussein. What you drive in a car, or you coming in other means of transportation. But this walking, this procession, considered a public resistance to the regime through opposing the principles of regime and by supporting the principles of the uprising or the revolution of Imam Hussein.
It's the walk, it's the march.
It is the walk, it is this public symbolic of commitment. And historically, people walk it kind of, they answering the call of Imam Hussein, because they said in the last hours of his life, when all his followers killed, and he stand and make a call, is there any supporter would come and support us? It's like he was calling through the history of the generations and generations and generations to come after him. And that's why the term, once you ask me about Labbaik Ya Hussein, that people will recite this theme in their walking, reflecting, here I am coming to support you, Hussein.
And that can mean different things for different people, but there's really a connection there, that there's a sense in which Hussein, or what he symbolizes, is real and present.
Exactly. It could be kind of multi-layered. Mm-hmm. Because most of all, for all the Shia, they connect to him in religious base of belief that he was the legitimate leader, and he is the kind of the divine leadership of the society. Then the attachment to him as a human being who objected and took very strong stand against oppression, against injustice, against violation of human rights and so on and so forth. And that's what really related to non-Muslims when they related to Imam Hussein and his uprising and his stand against the Umayyad dynasty at that time.
Well, I know I found myself very much attracted to Hussein and his willingness to tell what he thought was true, to stand up for his principles regardless of his opposition. It's just a matter of moral integrity par excellence.
Exactly. Because we believe that God wants us to enjoy the life through the good things a human being should do in the society. And when there is a deviated leadership or a governor or prime minister or a king or whatever, that could corrupt the whole societies. And in our contemporary history example, we see that very clearly. This is why the emphasis in the legitimacy and the moral leadership that should take the lead in the society.
Well, I want to go to one place. It's kind of a maybe a bit of a political question, but so was it a good thing for Saddam Hussein to be removed from power?
Well, that was a very good thing for the majority of Iraqi people, particularly the Shia, being the oppression, because Saddam was very clear, either you join and accept the rule of the government or you will be subjected to severe punishment. And it is very clear, not just among the Shia in Iraq, actually even among Sunni, among non-Muslims in Iraq who had any kind of objection to what he's been doing, that they faced a severe punishment, killing, torturing, disappearing with no any trace. And this is very well documented, actually. It is not just because I am a Shia saying this about Saddam. And his brutality were actually extended beyond the border of Iraq as well. This is why when Saddam being removed from power, it was a good relief from the oppression the majority of Iraqi society were facing. But unfortunately, the process being removing him was in the right way in order to secure the changes that will happen in the Iraq after him. And that's why, unfortunately, still Iraq in kind of a very bad shape with regard to the economy, regard to the political structure being put in the way that always make the Iraqi government is just very limited to be a very effective government to serve the needs of Iraqi people.
Well, I know I was certainly opposed from the very beginning to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and so now I'm finding myself, well, wait a second, was this a good thing?
Well, that's, again, it's really kind of a complicated issue where you look at it. For the people that say, yeah, it's good we get rid of the oppression from Saddam and the threat, continuous threat of Saddam. But unfortunately, after Saddam, the majority of people were hoping that hoping that Iraq will become a very successful country, very successful state. It hasn't been, unfortunately, established. So politically, it is a good change. But economically, socially, it is still not a good change.
And of course, the complications of the United States being involved in there, as well as the saber rattling with Iran and so forth. So, do you think now with Arbaine and the rising popularity of it that this might be a resistance movement for peace?
A resistance for peace.
A movement to make peace.
Movement to make peace. That's what majority of people would hope for, the aspect of establishment, the social justice that will be the principle for the peace of the society. Because I really believe that you cannot have a real peace with discrimination, with the misdistribution of the wealth into society, or allowing, for instance, the elite to be in the charge of the society and the majority being just living in the crumbs and so on and so forth. So that's the aspect of the peaceful, because, again, as I said earlier, is the purpose of so-called the divine religion is really to have man to achieve his perfection in his existence in this life, and that cannot be achieved without a total justice in the society and fairness among all the members of that society.
Imam Mohsen Al-Dahlemi is my guest. We're talking about Arbaine, the pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein that is happening now. This is something that's the Western media doesn't talk about very much. I've yet to find a person who isn't a Muslim who even has even heard of this.
Yes.
And so it's a huge thing that's happening. And we're talking about the pilgrimage itself. Tell me about can this popularity really strengthen? Is this kind of a rise, for example, of the Shias? And I want to another question before I get to that one or with that one. All along the way, the polls between Najaf and Karbala every 50 meters, and recently they've put up pictures of martyrs, young men who have resisted Daesh and the terrorist groups, and people in the West often confuse. They don't even know. Sean Hannity of Fox News had his funny hat on, and he's saying that ISIS and Hezbollah and they're all the same, and people don't even know the differences. But it was really the Shias who were the major brunt of a great deal of the terrorism from Daesh and Al Qaeda. Is that right?
That's very true. Actually, the resistance that even the Iraqi army in 2014, when the Daesh or ISIS took over the majority of the northwestern Iraq, Mosul, and the surrounding. Unfortunately, the Iraqi army kind of, most people would say, collapsed and allowed them to. And it was for the religious decree by the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani who asked the people, the community, to take the arm and resist Daesh because they were a fear of through, of course, the experience of they have what they have been done and before them the Qaeda in Iraq, because they always considered the Shia are heretics and they targeted them with so many so-called suicide bombers, car bombs, and they even, you know, unfortunately, they tried to destroy one of the shrines of two imams in Samarra, which brought, unfortunately, a lot of sectarian conflict in Iraq because many Shia consider that attack on the basic of their own belief and what they stand for. So it was really for the so-called popular mobilization that those people who took arm and take a stand opposing Daesh and fighting with the Iraqi armies or whatever left of the Iraqi armies, and they played a major role in dislodge Daesh and eventually by, you know, defeating them and drive them out of the Iraq, Mosul's and the other part of it. So yes, these mostly of these people really did not related with any specific group of political parties or, but their families or some people who are associated one would put their pictures. To again, because the concept of martyrdom is the most aspect known for the movement of Imam Hussein al-Islam, the willing to sacrifice yourself for the others. And these people find it religiously and morally is so strong giving that they are willing to sacrifice themselves in order to save the others, in order to defend the right, in order to take a stand against the oppression of the Daesh and ISIS. This is why people, they put these pictures all of them were the martyrs during the fight against the ISIS.
And so some people might say, well, why did Imam Hussein do this? I mean, wasn't it... he had no hope of winning. He had. Why would he give his life up? What was gained by all of that?
Well, the gain is now very, very clear through all over the history. First of all, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was knowing that he is facing militarily, he will not win. But taking the stand in the principles by opposing the oppressor, by opposing the unjust, that is what really needed to motivate the community, the society, to take the stand against the oppression of that time. And actually, immediately after his martyrdom in 61, so many uprisings and revolutions and movement against the Umayyad dynasty, which is took only 60 years to destroy it after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. And we should remember historically, at that time, Umayyad Empire, if I may call it, were controlling a huge, huge part of the Middle East. So it was a very, very strong state in our today or contemporary understanding, and yet the resistance managed to collapse it. So that's what the indication, and after that, actually, the resistance continued. And this is why there is a very beautiful saying, is that كل يوم عاشوراء كل أرض كربلاء. Instead, every day is the day of Ashura, which means that every day we face the challenge of taking a stand in principles against the oppression. So it is not only the day of Ashura that we should associate with, but every day in our life. And the other part when it says every land is like the land of Karbala, which is the land where Imam Hussein took that stand, posing thousands and thousands of army, yet he had only 70 or 80 people with him. And he was exposing not only himself and his fellow, but even his own immediate family, because he knew if they killed him and eliminate him physically, his role will be totally covered. But when he brought his the family, and the family carried the message of him after he's been martyred, particularly by his sister Zainab, and that's how his uprising, his revolution, his message being spread after him and continued up to today.
We just have about a minute and a half left, and I'd love to talk with you all day about this. But I also want to ask you about the Islamic Center of Portland and various ways that you might be commemorating Imam Hussein's sacrifice, and whether or not your masjid is open to other folks to come and see. What programs do you have?
Mainly our center serves the religious need of our community, the Shia, the follower of Ahlul Bayt, we send them, the descendant of Prophet. And we do basic services like the daily prayers, the Friday prayers. During the month of Ramadan, the month of our fasting, we have every day communal breaking of fast and some classes to recite Quran and recite special supplications. Traditionally, people will commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam the first 10 days of the month of Muharram, which is the first month of our lunar calendar. And usually we invite the speaker, and after this main speech and lecture, there will be lamentation and some kind of traditional mourning. We call it Aza, where people showing their grievance and sadness of what Imam Hussein and his family had faced. And the same thing, we celebrate the Arba'een. We have the weekend celebration of that, well, I should say commemoration, when we invited the speaker as well, and the community will share in coming to the center. Beside that, the center offers some other requirement, like helping with the marriage, helping with the preparing dead for burial. I do domestic counseling or family counseling. We have a Sunday school for the children of the community to teach them a basic teaching about Islam and languages, and so on and so forth. Yeah,
and then of course our two communities have had, we've celebrated the birthdays of the prophets Muhammad and Jesus, or Isa, peace be upon them both.
Yeah, actually we are trying to establish the community relation through many interfaith dialogue and visiting. And once last year we had the open house to have the neighbors and the people of the neighborhood to come on and introduce them, and we introduce ourselves to them.
I would love to have a conference with you about the historical Jesus and the historical Hussein. I think that would be an exciting...
Which they are have many, many things in common, actually.
I think so.
The concept of the principle of humanity.
Absolutely. Imam Muhsin Al-Dalami has been my guest. He is the Imam for the Islamic Center of Portland. You've been listening to The Beloved Community. You can catch The Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 o'clock on KBOO. And you can go to the website, kboo.fm/beloved community, or my website, progressivespirit.net, for podcasts of this show, as well as my weekly syndicated show, Progressive Spirit. I'm John Shuck. Good day.
Hussein, you are my guide, my hour of need, when I am all alone.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society's concert season, which this month features the Kathy Kallick Bluegrass Band, October 19th, 7:30 p.m., at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Kathy Kallick is an award-winning singer-songwriter, having received a Grammy and international bluegrass music accolades. Her five-piece band features more IBMA winners, including local fiddler Annie Staninetz, a former Emerging Artist of the Year. Portland Folk Music Society concerts in November will bring the Honey Whiskey Trio and Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball on a special pre-holiday program. PFS presents concerts monthly, now through next May. For more information, go to the website, kboo.fm, and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.